Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, thank you. My name is Ben Coleman. I represent the appellant, Yulee Kreuter. This appeal from the denial of a quorum nobis petition has essentially boiled down to the second prong of the quorum nobis test, which is whether there were valid reasons as to why the conviction wasn't challenged earlier, and the related question of latches. On that second prong, our position is that this case should be governed by Kwan, that the circumstances here are similar to this court's prior decision in Kwan, and therefore there were valid reasons for not challenging the conviction earlier. I think the heart of the problem with the magistrate judge's analysis and the report and recommendation is at page 11 of the excerpts of record, where the magistrate judge distinguished this case from Kwan on the basis that in Kwan, the petitioner was specifically advised that he could not collaterally attack, or he should not collaterally attack, his conviction. And that is just simply wrong. That fact did not exist in Kwan. Kwan was not specifically told by his lawyer that he could not or should not collaterally attack his conviction. Kwan did the same thing that Mr. Kreuter did, which is that he pursued administrative remedies first. And that, frankly, should be the rule, that it typically in civil cases, when it comes to latches and delay, a plaintiff is not held accountable for the period of time in which he or she is seeking administrative remedies. In addition, federal courts in general want to defer the determination of constitutional questions until non-constitutional avenues of relief are exhausted. Here, the petition obviously raises a constitutional question under the Sixth Amendment, and the course should be to pursue administrative remedies before seeking relief, if that is a way that the constitutional question in a federal case can be avoided.
Counsel, that is what. Could you address, I mean, so there's a couple periods of delay here that we can sort of look at separately. Could you address the last year or two of delay? So as I understand it, in 2014, it became clear that his conviction made him removable. And he didn't file until May of 2016. Under circuit precedent at the time, under Kwan, it was clear that there had been a constitutional violation because of the bad advice from counsel when he pleaded. So why is that last period of delay excusable?
Well, I guess I would disagree that it was clear that he could seek relief under Kwan, because, of course, by the time of 2014, the Supreme Court had decided Chavez in 2013, and the only relevant circuit precedent, I believe, at the time in 2014 was the Seventh Circuit's decision that Chavez applied both to non-advice and improper advice. So the circuit authority that he was dealing with at the time tended to suggest that he could not get relief through a quorum nobis petition. Then in 2015, this court decides Chan and says, no, Kwan is different than Chavez, and that Kwan applies retroactively. And then
even before Chan, I mean, I guess I'll grant, you know, it wasn't a slam dunk, but he had circuit precedent. He had, you know, Chavez sort of expressly noted Kwan and distinguished that as a different situation of, you know, affirmative bad advice as opposed to simply not addressing the question. So even if it wasn't 100% clear, like, he still had a pretty good argument. Well, why shouldn't we expect people in that position to actually make the argument they have rather than simply sit and wait and hope that somebody else brings a case?
Well, you know, I think it comes back down to Kwan again, in that he's not simply sitting and waiting. He is still pursuing administrative relief. And in Kwan, I mean, Kwan could have filed his petition at Jump Street, so to speak. But this court said that it was permissible for him to have exhausted his administrative remedies first before then seeking the petition. In addition, I just would also note that, you know, Chan itself was a divided opinion. I mean, this was a a very unclear issue at the time. Chan actually resulted in three different opinions and was a split decision with Judge Okuda dissenting. So this was an unclear issue at the time. In addition, in order to file the quorum nobis petition, there were a variety of things that he needed to get together, including in this case, I would note an unusual factor about this petition is that he actually was able to obtain the declaration of the former assistant United States attorney who was handling the case, and the prosecutor submitted a declaration saying that he would have considered an alternative plea to a misprison of felony. So there were things that did need to be done in order to perfect the record for this petition. And when
can I interrupt you for a second? Our analysis in this, we have to be specific about what bad advice your client got that would trigger a Sixth Amendment injury. So I want to be clear on what bad advice you're focusing on. It seems to be that you're focusing on immigration-related advice at the time that he went back to court for sentencing, as opposed to anything else that his sentencing counsel told him. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. And that is, he didn't receive any advice pre-plea from his lawyer, but Chavez says we can't attack that, because that's not retroactive. But we can attack misadvice, and the misadvice that he received was post-plea when his lawyer advised him that, well, the immigration authorities aren't going to find out about this, just lay low, rather than advising him, well, you should try to negotiate an alternative plea, which seems like it's something he probably could have done, or at least there's a legitimate chance that he could have done. And that's the misadvice that we are attacking. So although we don't think he received effective assistance, and he didn't receive effective assistance pre-plea, because of Chavez, we can't challenge that, because that's not retroactive. But the misadvice is something that we can challenge at this stage. So I did also want to emphasize one point, and I think this comes out from Kwan as well, is that one of the things that the government has argued about prejudice is that, well, witnesses may have been lost, or documents may have been lost, and things like that. But the relief that was ordered in Kwan was simply to adjust the sentence from a year and a day to a lesser sentence of under a year, so that the defendant wouldn't be deportable as an aggravated felon. I mean, here, we're not necessarily asking that the entire conviction be vacated. We're simply asking that the conviction be reformulated or reconstituted as a misprison of felony, which it seems like he likely could have received. I mean, he'll still have a felony on his record. He still served his sentence. He's paid the restitution. It's not a dramatic form of relief that we're requesting. And when you factor that in...
to be clear, you're asking that from this court, from the appellate court?
Well, we do believe that this court can enter that relief, because the government has not challenged our position on the fact that he did receive ineffective assistance. They didn't respond to that in their briefs.
That's an issue, though. Does an appellate court, I don't normally sit as an appellate judge, but I'd be surprised if an appellate court could basically order the government to charge somebody with a particular crime, then order the district court to put in a conviction on that crime, and then order the district court as to what sentence it must impose after imposing a conviction for the crime that the government's been ordered to charge. That seems like a lot of power on behalf of an appellate court.
Well, the quorum nobis and habeas allow a federal court to grant a wide variety of relief. There are cases where courts modify judgments and do things similar to this, and I can certainly can provide some of those. But we're not asking the court to necessarily alter the sentence. It would just be modifying the judgment to a misprison of felony rather than the current fraud conviction. Of course, the court could just vacate the conviction. That's a relief that a quorum nobis court can enter, and courts do that. But I don't think the court necessarily has to do that. And if the court thinks that there needs to be further consideration of the appropriate form of relief, it can remand to the district court to consider some of these matters as well. we think that this court does have that authority, but if the court thinks it's a better course to remand it, we would certainly advocate for that as well. If there are no other questions, I see that I've...
We'll give you some time for rebuttal. Thank you. We'll hear from the government next.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. Matthew Morris, I represent the United States. The district court in this case correctly denied this petition based on the valid reasons factor from this court's Hirabayashi test. I think appellant, or in this case, just we agree that it's really boiled down to that factor at this point. So there are, again, the four factors, one of which was never disputed. That was the other remedies aren't available. The government did dispute the adverse consequences. We lost that, and we chose not to appeal it. We won on this valid reasons test, and that's really the issue before this court. And the court below never reached the question of ineffective assistance, so that was never, there's nothing before this court to review on that. So to be clear, the magistrate in this case considered Mr. Kroithorst's proffered excuses, took everything that he said at face value, accredited it, and assumed it was true. And then the magistrate looked to this court's opinion in Rydell, which is really the closest opinion that's out there on this question of valid reasons for failing to act sooner, and found that Mr. Kroithorst's delay was even more egregious than the one that this court upheld in Rydell as being too egregious. So Rydell, I think, is instructive. It's a case with a similar time period. It was a 9-year delay, similar to the 9-year delay in this case. In that case, the petitioner said, I've been in prison. I've actually been deported. I had diminished mental capacity. I didn't have money to hire a lawyer. And this court found that those factors alone or in combination were not sufficient to excuse a delay in bringing the Coram Novus petition. And I think the magistrate was correct, and the district court was correct in adopting this. That is the closest case, and it's a published opinion from this court, and the magistrate was following what this court is said to do.
Could you address the time period, excuse me, between Chaydez and Chan, where it wasn't completely clear if this sort of argument was even available to petitioner?
Sure, Your Honor. First, I think it is the case that we're talking about 2-year period between 2014 and 2016. That's the type of length of delay that this court doesn't find appropriate. But I think what's important to look at is that when this court looked at Chaydez and Chan, this court in Chan said, look, Kwan didn't actually announce a new rule. So what happened in Chan was the district court had said Kwan was a new rule and then did a Teague v. Lane analysis and said, but Kwan is not retroactive. In Chan, this court said Kwan did not announce a new rule. So Kwan is simply announcing something that was the case even before Kwan. So it was relying, for example, on the ability of, the requirements that a lawyer give correct advice. So even if it were the case that Chaydez announces a new rule, now we've got a 2-year period between Chaydez and the failure to file the petition. But the district court, I think, was correct to have gone earlier and looked at the time period from the notice to appear, which is back in 2007, up until the petition in 2016. That's really what this court did in Kwan. So, and by the way, Chan was also a case where the timeliness was not a factor. So Kwan, of the cases we've talked about this morning, was a case where this court looked at timeliness under the valid reasons factor. And there the court did the measurement from the time that Mr. Kwan received a notice to appear in 2000, was found deportable in 2001, and then filed his quorum notice in 2002, and said that it was timely under those circumstances. So if we take what this court did in Kwan as instructive, then the district court was right to have looked at this from the perspective of when was he told that his conviction was going to make him removable. And that was way back in either 2007 or 2008, depending on which of the two notices to appear we're basing this off of.
But during that, at least for some time, and I think at least until 2014, he thought that he might be able to get relief through the immigration proceedings on some other basis. So, why isn't it a valid reason to want to pursue that process rather than to file what might prove to be an unnecessary coram nobis petition to have the conviction vacated?
Well, first of all, just because he has an alternate route, which is to go through immigration processes, doesn't mean that he's excused from pursuing in this court vacating the conviction. there's any number of things, that ways that people might choose to try to mitigate the effects of a conviction. But the quorum nobis, according to both this court and the Supreme Court, is supposed to be reserved for these very rare circumstances. So the fact that he made the choice, and in fact is choosing to continue to this day to fight his immigration consequences in immigration court, doesn't relieve him of the fact that he had an available remedy and he chose not to pursue it in terms of attacking the conviction.
So counsel, I mean, I think the question to follow up on Judge Miller's point is, what in that sort of mid-period, what did Mr. Kreuter know that that gave him notice that he had this other ability to challenge through this process that we're talking about now? Yeah, as I went through the record, it seemed like his lawyers in that mid-period were saying, you've got some immigration avenues available to you, you know, through family relationships or whatever. But I didn't find anything that said that he was put on notice that he could try and undo this conviction that he had. I mean, yes, he had a notice to appear that was triggered off of the conviction, but did he have any advice to say that he had a way to get around that by trying to get the conviction set aside?
There's nothing in the record on that, and this goes to this question of whether or not this is an error of the most fundamental character. And so if we look at ER 345 to 348 roughly, the government said, if you can't resolve this on the pleadings, if it becomes a question of what advice did he receive from his immigration lawyers and what advice did he receive from the Hesnelian, we're going to need a hearing on that. The court didn't reach that question, so the court didn't reach the question of what advice was received in that perspective, in that time period. But I think a second answer to the court's question is, there's certainly nothing in the law of this court that says that somehow a time period starts being measured at a time when a defendant knows that he has some remedy available. None of the Hirabayashi factors talk about saying, well, you knew that quorum nobis specifically was a route that was available to you, and here's our evidence of that, because we're rarely going to have that kind of evidence. It would make sense that we're going to come back after the fact, in this case 13 years later, to say what was known by whom about what remedies were available. What we do know is that in 2005, when he was still serving probation, Kwan was decided, saying that quorum nobis is available for affirmative misrepresentations of counsel. I'll turn briefly to this question of the latches and the government's prejudice here, if I could, because this is not a case.
Before you address the prejudice, can I just ask you, I can't figure out what the latches defense adds to just the normal quorum nobis analysis. I mean, if it's a reasonable delay, then you don't have latches, and if it's not a reasonable delay, then you don't get quorum nobis release. What is this adding to just the normal quorum nobis test?
There have been very few cases that have dealt with that question, Your Honor. So I would point the court, one of them would be Riedel. There's actually some discussion at the end of Riedel about the interrelationship between the valid reasons test in Hirabayashi and latches. What I can say is that this court has said they are separate. This court has said that one is not purely a subset of the other. So I think the court's question is getting to, isn't latches just a subset of valid reasons?
Well, I know that the Ninth Circuit has said that, and I've looked for an explanation, and I can't figure out how the government could win on latches while losing under the normal quorum nobis test.
Well, I think part of the answer to that, I think, would be to look at the language. So Hirabayashi says valid reasons exist for not attacking it sooner, whereas latches talks about reasonable diligence. And so I think you have to read or infer from that that the court has said that there will be some set of cases out there where you might satisfy Hirabayashi's valid reasons test, but that you will still lose on the due diligence, which is a separate language. So you could have valid reasons, but you still didn't do the due diligence, likely then taking into consideration the nature of the prejudice that the government suffered from the delay. So I think the more direct answer to the court's question is, Riedel talks briefly about this, and there were two claims there, both of which were barred by the valid reasons test of Hirabayashi, but the court then went into some latches discussion and said, well, one of them would be barred by latches and one would not, but it did not really explicitly answer the question that the court has about what exactly is that amount of daylight, or what's the Venn diagram of these two subsets. I see I'm very short on time. I'll just mention, if the court would look to ER 205 to 207, that was my declaration where I spelled out the things that I did to try to investigate whether we could defend this petition or re-prosecute the case, and sort of the roadblocks that I met in trying to find that evidence. And then I think, Judge Schiltz, to answer your question, this question of whether or not the court can order the government to charge Ms. Prison and then take the plea and then sentence him, we also addressed that in our briefing before the district court, and really it can't. That really would be a serious constitutional problem where a court, whether it's district court or court of appeals, is ordering the government, you shall charge him with a particular crime so that we can let him plead to that crime. And we addressed that in our briefing below also, roughly ER 350, I think, but give or take 5 pages. I see I'm out of time. I'll answer any other questions the court might have. If not, I'll simply ask the court to affirm.
Thank you, counsel. And Mr. Coleman, we'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to focus on that period from 2014 to 2016, since there have been some questions about it. In 2014, he learns that the strong likelihood is that the immigration courts aren't going to give you relief because they're going to consider your conviction to be an aggravated felony. But at that time, so it's not looking too good in immigration court. But at that time, he also has some serious problems with the quorum nobis petition, because in 2013, in Chavez, the Supreme Court says that Padilla is not retroactive. And then the Seventh Circuit, which is the only court at the time to consider it, says, well, Chavez also applies to erroneous advice as well. So he's got a problem there as well. And so it's reasonable and would be a valid reason to say, well, we'll continue with the immigration relief because we've got problems on both ends. Then in July of 2015 is when this court decides Chan. And this court says that, that Kwan applies retroactively, misadvice applies retroactively. This is different than Chavez. So at that point, now he knows, okay, I've now got a good chance in quorum nobis relief. And then he goes forward with that. Now he files the petition in May of 2016. And that is, I guess, about 9, 10 months after Chavez. In that time, he does a variety of things, including getting the declaration from the AUSA, which I had mentioned. But I also think that this court can look at 28 USC 2244, which basically sets a one-year deadline once law is determined to apply retroactively. That affords a petitioner 1 year to file a petition, and he is within that year period, because Chan comes out in July of 2015, and then he files in May of 2016. And so I think that there are valid reasons for not filing the petition any earlier, and that the case should at least be sent back for a remand to consider the other issues in the case, or that this court has the authority to enter the relief we request.
Right. Thank you, counsel. We thank both counsel for their helpful arguments, and the case is submitted.